It's Wednesday, July 18th, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai throws everyone a curveball and appeared to be putting the brakes on the Sinclair Tribune merger, saying that he has some serious concerns about the legality of some of those plans. Today, some of them turned around again. We're going to talk about that. A judge asks the Los Angeles Times to remove some details that were in a story that it published after some information was inadvertently made public. And the paper agreed to do it, at least in the short term. There have been some developments in that case, too, we're going to talk about. And Sacha Baron Cohen is back, asking who is America. We'll talk about his new program that's on Showtime and why some are saying it's giving the right a taste of what fake news really is. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up, but we've got to start talking about what happened in Helsinki and the reactions since then. I'm starting to think I have whiplash.
I've had several emotions, and most of them are all in one direction. Here's the thing for me. I can see how a president or a high-ranking diplomat needs to walk back something they said that might have inadvertently caused problems. You know, that's expected, but usually when the person does that, they at least pretend like they really mean it when they walk it back, but not President Trump. I mean, you know, basically he said that he meant to say wouldn't whenever he said would when he was criticized for basically saying that he believed Vladimir Putin more than he believed our U.S. intelligence agencies. Well, if you ask me, the problem with that is that, you know, nothing else he said in the news conference didn't not line up with the correction that he made.
Okay, we're all going to need to take a second and keep counting the double negatives to know exactly what side of this we're on.
Well, I mean, I think Mike's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a classic pattern that we've seen from President Trump, that we saw from candidate Trump, that we saw from the businessman Trump. He's never wrong. He's never completely wrong. He's never going to completely apologize, but he's going to give you just enough to, at least in his mind, satisfy your need to feel as if, you know, you were right, but in fact, he's the one who's right and is always following his own path, and his path is the right path.
Oh, but wait, Ernest. I mean, this is a special moment. This is even worse than Charlottesville, which was supposed to be the big game-changing moment. And Trump came out and he had to make a correction, so to speak. Until what? This morning he tweeted, "So many people at the higher ends of intelligence loved my press conference performance and said that Russia was no longer targeting the United States." Even that little turnaround.
So would that person at the high end of intelligence be Rand Paul? Because...
Because he seemed to be the only person,
exactly, the only person that I saw not condemning this. I mean, even Newt Gingrich, who had stood fast with him throughout.
Rick Santorum actually saying, "I'm not apologizing for the president, but I kind of am."
Exactly.
But you know, I mean, the point I think you were starting on, and I certainly agree with this, is do we really think that this news conference with Putin is somehow going to be a turning point for Trump, that he doesn't even have to try very hard to make up a lame excuse anymore. And people will say, okay, on with the next thing. Congress, you know, some of the Republican leaders decried what he said, but not who said it. And they're not going to do anything about it that's substantive.
I don't think, and I've had numerous conversations with people over the last couple of days, I don't think that anything is really going to happen until November. Mm-hmm. It will mm-hmm. take elections and the Republicans losing a lot of key elections before they begin to do, if that happens. Now, if that doesn't happen, then, you know, you're definitely going to have the president saying, "See, I told you so." But I think up until that moment, we're going to continue to go down this road until it begins to have some sort of electoral
impact
or outcome on them. Now, when we talk about the media's role, I mean, it was Charlottesville all over again, where you had the media and especially the pundits and even the anchors coming out in this sort of high volume of, I can't believe.
Anderson Cooper described it as one of the most disgraceful performances by a president that he'd ever seen.
Yeah.
Using the word disgraceful.
Yeah, yeah.
And the same people who support President Trump, and apparently an increasing number of Republicans who support President Trump, none of that matters. CNN has already been factored into the equation. Mm-hmm. They're fake news. They don't matter. Anything that they say, whether it's a news caster, whether it's a pundit, it just doesn't matter. And it seems to me like that even if you're a Trump supporter, there are a couple of questions about this meeting with Putin that you should still care about. No. And that the media have to try to find answers to. What did they talk about for two mm-hmm. plus hours in that room? And does the president ever prepare for any meetings with any foreign leaders, no matter how important the meetings are?
I mean, I remember distinctly Chuck Schumer, who's the minority leader in the Senate, imploring someone to be in the room with Trump mm-hmm. during his meeting with Putin. And then you see this press conference, and then all of a sudden you have people asking the question, well, if he's saying this in an open press conference,
what happened behind closed doors
for 2 hours?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the scary part right there. And I guess the other narrative that's starting to play out, and this is where I think, you know, journalists and even investigative journalists need to get back on this, is, you know, what is the connection between Trump and Trump as a businessman and Trump as a corporate entity and the Russians? Because there is a trail there, but people were talking about this before this meeting, and now they're really talking about, was he serving the interests of the United States, or was he serving the interests of Trump corporate? Mm-hmm. I mean, that I think is a story that really needs to that the journalists need to get back on.
And again, back to the point you made about Schumer's call for someone else to be in the room, I don't know that we'll ever really get the answer to that question, because there was nobody in there to be able to know where to answer it.
Just the translators. And, you know, they're sworn to secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's another media aspect of this story that interests me. There's been this narrative for a while. I think maybe now we should stop calling it a narrative and calling it a fantasy. And that's that no matter what the president says, there are adults in the room, quote unquote, who will somehow ameliorate against his tendencies. And I think this whole trip that he's been on, whether it was the NATO summit or what he said to a Murdoch paper, which he then called fake news about Theresa May, on and on and on, mm-hmm. there are not going to be any, quote, adults in the
room
who are
going to
make
Twitter.
The president do or say what he doesn't want to do or say.
Those folks were fired over Twitter months ago.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we've seen it time and time again where there's supposed to be, you know, let's think about all the staffers that have gone through the White House in the 18 months that he's been there. And his chief of staff is supposed to be there. And Sarah Huckabee is supposed to be there, mm-hmm. Making sure that everything. But then again, he gets on and he pretty much goes off script. And almost every single time that he goes off script, it becomes the bigger story. But I go back to what we've said over and over again on this show. We're not really paying attention to what's actually happening when it comes to policy. I mean, you think about what's happening with the trade wars and what's going to be happening, you know, what's already happening in terms of right here in the Midwest, mm-hmm. where you have farmers who are concerned, you have manufacturers who are concerned, you have people who have real jobs and real lives who are concerned about the policies that this administration has implemented.
And I understand that requires a level of discipline that I'm not sure any journalist can really follow with. I mean, Trump is making news,
oh, yeah.
but to cover those kinds of stories the way we should, that's a problem. And there's one of you started this conversation, Amy, by talking about whiplash.
Yes.
Okay, here's some whiplash for me.
Okay.
Chris Wallace.
Yes.
Fox News Channel journalist, mm-hmm. interviewing Vladimir Putin, mm-hmm. and he is sticking it to him, and he's asking him tough,
that was a really good
questions.
Anybody
interview.
Who disagrees with you turns up dead or close to it.
Yeah. Anybody else on that channel? Well, especially the big talk show hosts, right? Whether it's Sean Hannity or Tucker Carlson or the folks in the morning,
right.
you would not know that any of that happened.
Right, and the fact that you had basically he hands Putin.
Mm-hmm.
The indictment,
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. hands it to him. Mm-hmm. And Putin's like, I'll just put it on the table over there. I'll get to it later. I mean, it was sort of watching both the press conference and Chris Wallace's interview. I mean, Putin was sitting there. I mean, it was almost like he was gloating. He was just like, I can't believe that I'm getting this much press and this much attention. I couldn't have manufactured this on my own any better than what you guys have done for me. I mean, it is just incredible.
Okay. So at the same time that case of whiplash was happening, I got another one. Got a real sore neck today. Monday, at about the same time that this Putin and Trump news conference was going on in Helsinki, we also got some news here at home that frankly distracted me because I was paying attention to both of them at once. The breaking news that at the time, the FCC was not going to give Sinclair the free pass that many of us had expected in green lighting the merger with Tribune Media. FCC Chair Ajit Pai said that he had some serious concerns that the sidecar ownership deal wasn't legal. Early this morning, word comes out that Sinclair is looking to restructure the deal, getting rid of that sidecar ownership deal with WGN-TV and a couple of the others. And they're trying to get this back on the rails.
Well, so first of all, what the sidecar deal is, for people who haven't followed it as closely as we have, basically, Sinclair was going to own too many TV stations, too much control if they didn't divest themselves of some major stations. And WGN in Chicago is one, or the station in Dallas, another one
in Houston.
Well, and so what Sinclair tried to do was, well, we're going to sell these to some friends of ours, but we're going to manage them.
It was like a car dealership company. Yeah.
We're going to manage them still. And Ajit Pai, you know, bless him, despite the fact that you would say, well, he's a Republican, free market, friendly to mergers, mm-hmm. friendly to capitalism, friendly to big corporations in the media, he saw through that as a problem. Now, what I don't know, there were a lot of people in the press who were saying, oh, wow, this might have scuttled the Sinclair Tribune. No, come on. I think what Pai was doing was sending a signal to Sinclair that you need to tidy this up so we can make this thing happen. And now, as you pointed out in an article on our Links blog, WGN is going to be bought wholesale by Sinclair. They're going to own it, and they're going to divest those other stations that don't mean as much to them. I think this merger is still going through. I just think that the chairman of the FCC needed a little bit more of a fig leaf to cover it than he had.
Well, one of the things that makes WGN so valuable to Sinclair is that it also has the Superstation, which runs on cable and satellite mm-hmm. services nationwide.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think Mike is absolutely right. I think he was sending him a message, sending Sinclair a message mm-hmm. that, you know, you're going to have to restructure this, because I think what it would have done if it had gone the way it was supposed to and the FCC had approved it was that it was going to open it up to lawsuits that would have definitely caused judges and other courts to basically look at this and go like, whoa, wait a minute, you're violating several statutes that are already on the books, and you don't want that kind of, I guess he would say, hey, I don't want that kind of scrutiny for the FCC, so you guys need to structure this in a way that we already know the lawsuits are coming, but at least
we can defend them.
We can defend it, yeah.
Well, and in Pai's defense, until we know otherwise, he hasn't withdrawn the notion that he's going to submit it to an administrative law review, which could take a long time if Sinclair doesn't get the signal. I think with their stock price and Tribune stock price tanking temporarily, they got the signal.
Yeah.
Well, a new show premiered on Showtime Sunday night, Sacha Baron Cohen's Who is America? The 30-minute mockumentary is pretty much what he did in Borat back in 2006. Went deep into character and interviewed the unsuspecting, usually leading to their humiliation and embarrassment. In this show, though, the people that he really seems to be going after are the political right. Sunday's show featured an interview with a really confused Bernie Sanders in which they were trying to calculate what the 1% is, and a pretty long sketch in which he got a lot of people on the right to agree to a fake Israeli program that teaches gifted four-year-olds how to properly use a gun so that they can be armed in schools. It was pretty dark. I don't know if you had an opportunity to watch the whole thing. The whole show is very dark. And we're going to start to see some other pretty big names get punked on it. Sarah Palin among those, also failed Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore.
Well, I mean, you know, you're right. It is dark. I haven't seen it. I've only seen the clips from it.
Yeah.
And even the clips themselves are pretty dark. I mean, to me, it sort of goes to, you know, the intelligence of some of the people who are going through this. I mean, to even sit down and have a conversation about a four-year-old being taught how to load a gun, use a gun. I mean,
with cartoon characters and puppets.
I mean, yeah. I mean,
I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. It's horribly sad.
It is, but to me, it's one of those things where, you know, how could someone actually believe that that's actually happening?
And I think that's why I'm laughing. Like, you didn't think this through?
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that I have a problem.
Well, I mean, it seemed. Caveat. I have not seen the first episode. I don't have Showtime. I saw the excerpts online. Mm-hmm. I never really was a big fan of the Ali G show on HBO. I saw Borat. So I don't have a lot of experience with Sacha Baron Cohen. But it seems to me he's gone the extra mile on the production values this time, setting up fake Twitter accounts and websites and having done it months ago to make
create
it harder.
Full digital footprints. There's actually a piece that's on our Links blog from Inside Higher Ed. Yeah. In which they detail how he created a whole persona. It's
a lot like the Russians, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Yeah. And I think maybe that's kind of the point he's trying to make in some ways, showing the right what fake news really is, creating this mock-you news magazine, if you would call it that.
You know, it so first of all, it's a creative thing. He has a right to do
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. It's satire.
People are going to gravitate toward it. It is a little bit concerning to me that folks on the left are okay with using these sort of fake news tactics when they were being used against people on the left, you know, by right wingers. Well, that was a problem.
Two wrongs don't make a right.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a trouble with that. And I also think that even though you're going to make some individual conservative, Sarah Palin or Dick Cheney or Roy Moore and these folks, I'm going to make them temporarily uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. They've already figured out what the comeback is, and it's right out of the president's playbook. They're just going to slam it as fake news. People are going to go on their merry way, and I don't think it's going to achieve a whole lot more than to maybe make folks on the left feel a little better about the times they're living in.
I mean, it sort of plays into the partisan divide that we have. The back and forth. You know, the sort of like, okay, now here's this show, which is the I gotcha for the left. As opposed to, you know, what goes on a daily basis in Washington right now, because the Republicans are in charge on the right. So, I mean, it's, you know, I'm not sure how much of a standing that this show is going to have after the initial, you know,
one or two or three episodes, people are going to be over it.
And then people are going to be going like, okay, this is the left doing what the right's doing.
Yeah.
I will say that if it was possible to get like a monthly subscription to Showtime, like you can get to, like, say, CBS All Access, I would tune in for an episode or two, and I would definitely tune in for the episode where apparently he's punked Ted Koppel, the journalist. I'd be curious to know what that was all about.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have been off for so many weeks this summer. We didn't really get a chance to talk about a lot of the things that have happened on the media beat. And that included the deadly shooting at the Capitol Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland. Newsrooms across the country have stepped up to help the Capitol Gazette continue to serve its community, including an effort that has been put in place in part between investigative reporters and editors and the Baltimore Sun to seek out volunteers from news organizations across the country to help staff on a volunteer basis that newsroom through the Christmas holidays. But there's one story that it refuses to take anybody's help on, covering the court proceedings against the shooter who killed 5 of its employees. The person who's covering the proceedings is Chase Cook. He is the man who has been known now more than by his own name, is the person who put out that tweet that said, "I can tell you this, we're putting out a damn paper tomorrow." He says this story is probably one of the most important he's going to cover in his entire life. And if he didn't step up to cover it, he was letting the shooter win.
Yeah, and I think he's being very honest about his motivation. I mean, he said, "I don't even know if this is ethical. I think it probably is, but I'm not going to let the shooter win by letting somebody else come in from corporate or a reporter from another of our papers to cover it." I don't know if that's the right choice in terms of, you know, I mean, one, it's going to put the journalists there, including him, you know, in a really interesting situation, trying to relive some of those situations. He was not in the newsroom when this happened, right? He was at home. But would it have been better to have another reporter from their group come in and cover this trial? Does it matter that maybe the reporter can't be perfectly unbiased in covering this guy? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's going to be difficult for him. It's going to be difficult for the editors who are going to have to edit that story and make sure that, you know, it's done in a way that it's fair. But then again, in a situation like this, what is fair? I mean, you know, you're trying to he makes a good point. We can't, you know, we need to cover this story, not to allow someone else to come in and do it who doesn't understand the history, doesn't understand the context, doesn't understand this place. That part would be missing from the story. And if we're going to cover this story in a way that really shows what this is about, then we need to do it ourselves. And maybe it's also this may be some way of him feeling as if, you know, he's helping his paper and his colleagues go through this process and heal. I mean, not everything sort of fits into the journalistic norms and the journalistic ethics that, you know, that we talk about all the time and that we try to espouse. Sometimes you have a story, you know, that doesn't necessarily fit into that.
Yeah, I will also say it's really, to me, it says a lot. You introduced it, Amy, about the fact that some folks put out a request to have folks come in and cover on holiday and all that kind of stuff.
Within 24 hours, people were told to stop volunteering because they have too many volunteers
That was led by investigative reporters and editors, which is based here, and they got like 350 or something volunteers, more they could. But that shows you something about how the journalistic community is rallying.
It's coming around that. Yeah. Okay, so I don't know, what was it now? Like 2 years ago, we talked about some of our first jobs on this show. And every time I get the opportunity, Ernest, I bring yours back and talk about it. Well, today we're going to talk about mine for a second, a scenario. I had mentioned that for a time I worked as a grocery store checker at a grocery store in Chicago. And the store had a policy. If there was a sign that was wrong, or if we scanned an item and the price came up wrong, the customer got that for free. That was the store's fault, nobody else's. Okay, let's keep that in mind as we go into this next story. So, Saturday, a federal judge ordered the LA Times to remove information from an article that described a plea agreement reached between prosecutors and a detective accused of working with the Mexican mafia. That agreement, as part of it, was that it was to have been placed under seal and never be made public. But there was a mistake that happened, and it was published, that plea agreement was published on a database called PACER that is used for federal court documents, making them public both to, you know, newsrooms and to anybody who wants to go see them. The LA Times, based on that judge's order on Saturday, edited the story, took out the information, and then went right to court and said, hey, that was your mistake. We didn't do anything wrong. We won't put that back in. Kind of like that grocery store thing. You programmed that scan code wrong, not us. Don't violate our First Amendment rights.
Yeah, I you know, when I first read this, I was doing some other work and it sort of popped up on my computer screen, and I went like, wait a minute, you know, a federal judge tells the paper
it has to unpublish.
That it has to basically pull that out, and the paper says yes. What is going on here? I mean, I couldn't believe that the LA Times would actually agree to do that. I mean, you were doing what you were supposed to do as journalists. And the court was the one that put that out there. Once you put it out there, you can't pull it back. It's almost like saying, you know, did I say wouldn't? You know,
I kept thinking of post-restraint.
Yeah.
You know, that idea of prior restraint and the government saying you can't publish something ahead of time. Post-restraint?
Yeah, it's like, how do you? And here's the other thing. Okay, if it's out there for not only the Post, I mean, for the LA Times, but for anybody. Mm-hmm. So did the judge just automatically say, and anybody else who has a blog out there, you got to pull it back too? I mean, come on.
And, you know, there's another sort of bad precedent that the judge is setting if that, I mean, he withdrew the order, but nonetheless, There have been people
leaking. 3 days later.
People have been leaking documents to the press forever. People who stole them. The Pentagon Papers, Edward Snowden. You can think of a lot of other cases in between. Journalists have a right to publish those things and to leave them out there for the public to see if they weren't complicit in the theft.
And I think the reason why the judge did that, I think he went like, oh, wait a minute. I think I overstepped my bounds. Like, I gotta pull this back. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, what he should have done was basically call in whoever the clerk was and say, what were you doing? Did you not hear me say this was not supposed to go out?
Or how did it get uploaded? How did this sealed agreement get uploaded in the first place?
And the supposed rationale for this whole thing was because the judge was concerned about the former cop who colluded with the Mexican mafia, his safety and the safety of his family. Fair enough, but there are ways to deal with that besides... What did you call it? Not future, toast restraint.
Toast restraint.
Okay, before we go, we're going to take another one of those fame trips into the Wayback Machine to the days of old. It seems that there will soon be only one Blockbuster Video left in these United States. With the closing of two in Alaska, the last one standing will be in Bend, Oregon. It's a city of about 76,000 people that's 160 miles outside of Portland. Soon enough, that term "be kind, rewind" is going to be totally dead.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this story as well over the weekend, and I was like, wow. I mean, I remember when, I mean, you couldn't throw a rock and not hit a Blockbuster Video. And now, I mean, other than Redbox, I guess, that's pretty much going to be it. And who knows how long that's going to, you know, that's going to last, because the way streaming is going now, I mean, everything is just going to be streamed in.
Well, and Blockbuster does, or at least did, have a streaming service, but never really found its niche to be able to compete with Netflix and Hulu.
Yeah, and you know, we all can remember back 20 years ago when, well, this is the greatest thing that you can get these DVDs
even
in the mail.
Or
videotapes in the stores. Okay, so, and we thought, that's never going away. That's too great.
How many Friday nights did we each spend walking in circles in those stores?
Yes,
what
are
we going to be saying 20 years from now? Is like, broadcast television is gone. This quaint thing where we're carrying around these little bricks in our pocket, well, now it's just all embedded in our head. What's going to be the quaint technology that goes away?
The Black Mirror episode with the contact lenses.
I mean, it's, you know, that, I think that's, you know, that's what we really need to be talking about here, is how quickly this has happened. I mean, you're right, it was only 20 years ago, but, you know, Redbox came out, it's been less than 10 years, and now it's headed in that same direction. And, you know, so where are we going to be?
Funny enough, I changed offices this week, and I have a large number of beta tapes that are in there, since that was the news standard for so long, even after the commercial standard. And I had to explain to somebody that it wasn't just like a regular VCR tape, that it was technology even before that. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. You can find that under the programs tab on kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions and see previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to Aaron Hay. He's our audio engineer, the guy responsible for making us sound good. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.